go.
And time for Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Let's talk Lake Stevens. The plans that originally called for a freeway-style interchange at Highway 9 and Highway 204 have been adjusted, shall we say. Chris, what are they going to do?
Well, what they were going to do is they were going to kind of put Highway 9 below Highway 204, right there at what they call Frontier Village. I talked about this project about a year ago, and some listeners had asked me, okay, what's the deal? Construction was supposed to start this year. It's one of the busiest highway interchanges there along Highway 9, because there's a whole bunch of shops there at Frontier Village. Well, Chris Olson at the Department of Transportation told me yesterday that they ran into a problem with the idea of taking Highway 9 down below grade to put 204 over the top.
What we discovered when we moved into our technical analysis is the groundwater is about 10 feet below the surface. In order to resist that groundwater pressure, we would have had to build some fairly significant walls and footings.
They would have had to go down about 30 to 60, maybe even more feet to below to make that handle on the ground, because the groundwater, the water table there was at 10. So that challenge in the design pushed the project way over budget, so they decided to do something different.
We discovered that it was going to be about $30 million beyond what we had budgeted. So we had to kind of go back to the drawing board a little bit, and we came up with a new design that should work just as well as, if not better, than the original.
The new design involves a series of four roundabouts, two of them on Highway 9 and two of them on the smaller surface streets nearby that access the shopping area.
The new intersection design actually calls for a series of roundabouts. It performs just as well as putting 9 underneath with free-flowing traffic, but it also provides a lot more options for people to get around the area in and out of Frontier Village.
And a lot of jockeying for position. They're close together, but the people will be able to get through it. You can see the design drawings up at MyNorthwest.com now. This new design was supposed to be unveiled to Lake Stevens residents tonight at an open house, but that meeting was canceled because of this week's weather. So it's also not just roundabouts that they're doing here. The state's going to be adding a lane in each direction of Highway 9 in that area to help improve capacity around there past the market areas through all the stores. Olson says construction on the southbound lane should begin this summer. The northbound lane should be added next year, and then the entire project should be completed in 2023. The reason it's going to take so long is the schedule's dependent on some right-of-way and property acquisitions that still need to happen. Budget for this project, $69 million. The original plan that they thought, again, would have pushed that closer to $100 million. So they said, nope, not going to do it. We're doing something different.
Four roundabouts. That sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, four roundabouts. The two smaller ones will help the businesses on the roads adjacent to Highway 9, but there are two biggies right in the middle of Highway 9, not too that too far apart. So we'll see how it goes. But yeah, you're not getting an elevated roadway. You're getting four roundabouts.
I took the tunnel this morning.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
I had a heck of a time finding it.
Yeah. Well, I told you it would take one or two times to figure it out.
I figured I'd go down Edgar Martinez, right? I-90 Edgar Martinez, right down to the stadium district, and there'd be a big sign saying, tunnel this-a-way. There's no such sign.
There isn't. Okay. So what you have to do is you go through that intersection.
Right.
And then you take a right just before the Atlantic overpass, and that road goes down to Dearborn, and then you enter the tunnel there at Dearborn, that new Dearborn intersection. So
you got to jog north.
Correct. So you go straight through the intersection at Edgar Martinez and First.
Yeah.
Take the next right. Mm-hmm. And that will put you directly onto the Dearborn on-ramp to northbound 99. Yeah, it's one or two times to kind of make sure you understand.
Could they put
that
a sign there at some point?
Yeah, I'm sure they probably will. That's probably a pretty good idea.
Maybe just balloons, because whenever there's a new thing, they put balloons up.
Maybe they're waiting for the northbound Dearborn off-ramp to open up before they tell people where to go.
Seems like we just voted, but now we're going to vote again. At least some of us will. There is a February special election, and Kyria Santa-Scott is here to tell us what is on that ballot.
So this is special elections, not generally about candidates. We're usually talking about fire district measures and schools. Schools are, and money for schools are the bulk of what we're talking about here in our February special election. In Seattle, there's a couple of school levies on the ballot to replace expiring ones. We've got Proposition 2. This is a $1.4 billion six-year levy that covers capital projects. It includes things like earthquake and other safety improvements at 16 schools, as well as some money for maintenance projects at dozens of other schools and security enhancements announcements at all schools. Seattle's Prop 1, a bit more controversial. This is a three-year, $815 million levy that covers educational and operations programs that are either not funded by the state or not fully funded by the state. Now, this would include everything from art and extracurricular programs to transportation and special education. The Seattle Times editorial board has urged a no vote on this one, calling it a political ploy aimed at lobbying lawmakers to lift the levy lid that came with the McCleary fix. They also point out that the levy asks for more than the amount that's currently allowed under that levy lid and over $210 million for special education, which the legislature has come up short on but has vowed to fix in this upcoming or in this session we're in right now. State School Superintendent Chris Reichdahl says the Times has it wrong.
School districts are allowed to ask their voters for more than they can collect in case the legislature changes their levy limits down the road. It's just prudent financial management. And what I tell the Times and others is, don't worry, we will only let them collect what they are actually allowed to collect, but they are certainly allowed to ask their voters for more authority in case they get that opportunity later. It's just smart money management.
So the critique here is that the state was supposed to fully fund education or adequately fund, whatever the term it is, and that local districts like Seattle or Bellevue or Mercer Island were not supposed to, again, be able to create luxury programs that the rest of the state can't create.
Right, absolutely. And these aren't luxury programs. These are what are called enhancements. So it will cover things like school nurses, counselors, additional teacher in
but
the classroom.
But are these enhancements that other poorer districts can't afford?
They can ask. And yes, in some cases, I would say yes. But this is something that the Seattle School District has said is they are just trying to do what they were currently doing already. So right. The way that McCleary Fix worked is it's spread out across the state, right, to be more fair. But Seattle ends up losing money in that deal. So they're going to come up with a $45 million shortfall just this next year because of that. And they want... There's a big push in Olympia to lift that levy lid to make that whole thing irrelevant to begin with. What they're doing here with Proposition 1 is asking for the authorization to have that amount okayed should the levy lid be lifted in Olympia, if that makes sense. Okay. At any rate, those are the two that we're talking about in Seattle. The other big Renton School District, by the way, has similar proposals as both of those on the ballot as well. Several other school districts across the state also have school construction bonds on the ballot. These are a big, big deal. Bethel School District Superintendent Tom Spiegel says they are once again asking voters to approve a $443 million bond proposal to cover the cost of a new high school and two new elementary schools, among other improvements. This has failed multiple times, just barely, including last November when it fell short of the 60% of the vote needed by just 307 votes. Spiegel's message to voters in the Pierce County District?
We're in a very dire situation to be able to put all our kids in a decent place. And the only way to do that that makes any sense at all is to build some new buildings and expand those current ones that need to be fixed anyway.
Now, this is going to be the sixth time this is up. If it does not make it, he says the school board is considering drastic options like split school days, boundary changes that are not good for parents or for schools. And for those voters who don't have kids and don't think it's a problem, he explains it like it's like roads, right? We have to, every taxpayer has to kick in on roads. It's the same for education. Now, it's the same story in the peninsula, the Yelm School District, several others across the state. Multiple times their measures have failed because of that 60% majority needed to pass a bond. There's that effort in Olympia we've talked about before to change that to a simple majority or 55%. It was up for a hearing yesterday, and several students affected by this came out to tell lawmakers why they needed change.
My peers are not wanting to go to school because they are concerned that their building may fall down around them. Our students are suffering because there is simply no room for them to learn. Our teachers have no room for teaching, so they leave and go to states with better quality buildings and education facilities.
Not only overcrowded, but it's overcrowded to the point of disrupting our classrooms.
There are sometimes upwards of 30 students in each classroom.
So what are the chances of that passing? That would be a pretty big change for Washington State, where you change the threshold necessary to pass these bond measures from 60 down to 55%.
To school bond measures. Remember, yeah. In most cases, most levies only take a simple majority as right. It is. So, yeah, it would be a big shift. And It's getting a lot of traction from what I can tell.
So you think there's a good chance of passing?
I would say yes. I would say yes. I would say more so than not at this point, but okay. We'll see. It's been proceeding nicely through.
What about Snohomish County?
Snohomish County, Arlington voters, again, same deal, right? They've been asking for this bond for a new high school and to replace post-middle school. That has failed multiple times, so that will be on the ballot. This is a lot of these, too, I want to point out for bond measures are for safety improvements at your schools, for exits, entrances, when we're talking about mass shootings, things like that, upgrades for buildings. We've got asbestos issues in some of the rural districts. So that's what these are all about. There are three similar proposals in Kitsap County for Central Kitsap, Bremerton, and Bainbridge Island school districts, and a slew of other things. There's a handful of things involving fire districts, and nothing that is a big financial issue that I can tell.
Yeah. Back to the Seattle School District levy. So the effect of the change in school funding was that the poorer districts got more, but districts like Seattle found their budgets cut. So it's basically an income shift to try and create some sort of equality.
Yes.
And my guess is that the parents in the schools that are going to lose money, I'm assuming it's going to happen in other districts like Bellevue too, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to tolerate that, are they?
Well, that's why we've got the push to lift the levy lid.
Yeah. But then doesn't that put us back to that sort of raises the standard. Now the other school district is going to say, wait a second, I thought we're going to have as much as Seattle and as much as Bellevue, and here they are raising more money than we can.
And that's some of the argument against lifting the levy lid. The other big issue here is special education, which is a special, separate deal altogether. That is something that's going to, the legislature has to do separately, and everyone has promised that it will get done. And I know there are bills moving through right now. So that Seattle levy is asking for that $210 million for special education specifically, that they basically what the Times, the editorial board and other critics from the Times have said, look, why don't you wait until April and put it on that special ballot instead of doing it in February? Let's wait and see what the legislature does, because the belief is that the legislature will give the money up for special education, so Seattle wouldn't need that money.
And that would go to all districts then?
That's okay. A statewide bill.
So everyone would get special education.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Money.
Well, that's only fair. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Chiropractor is Hannah Scott.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Though I won't do it. The DNA testing. Did you see the Bloomberg report that one of the DNA companies has sold the information to the FBI?
To see if you've been accused of a crime somewhere?
I don't know what the FBI... It reminds me of the Cambridge Analytica stuff.
Well, if it puts guilty people in jail, Colleen.
I won't do it. I'm not guilty, but I won't do it. Okay. A San Antonio woman decided to celebrate her 30th birthday in the most selfless way she possibly could.
I started to think about all these extravagant things that I wanted to do, my birthday cake. I wanted to have mariachis and I wanted them to serenade me. I stopped and said, wow, am I being selfish that I've been blessed with 30 wonderful years of life, and how many other children out there do not have the opportunity to have a wonderful birthday or experience these great things?
So Amanda Rico told KSAT TV that she decided to turn her birthday into a party for 130 kids, and she chose the St. PJ's Children Home. It's a home for abused and neglected kids. And she said the inspiration came from a book she read to her kids called Light Up the Darkness.
I was just a boy one winter's night beneath my favorite tree. It was the night of my 12th birthday, all alone as I could be. No cards, no cake, no candles, no presents wrapped for me, because no one threw a party for a little boy who couldn't see.
She said it brought her to tears, and she thought, this is what I need to do. I need to make kids feel special who might not otherwise get the chance. She said the big party was actually tough to pull together, receiving a few no's when she was asking for help. But then a friend who owns an entertainment business came through. They had food, a live DJ, games, just what the kids would want. And in addition to the party, she raised money on a GoFundMe page to buy clothes, shoes, and other things for the kids at PJ's house.
We're here for more than just ourselves. And so I want them to understand what that big global picture is.
That's from KSAT TV.
And now it's time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is from dog-friendly 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill.
You're not supposed to tell people, Dave. I'm going to get in trouble.
Look out behind you, Dave. Peach is right there.
I know. I feel this strange tail brushing my leg. But
it's such a foreign thing to have an animal.
That was actually me.
Near Dave. Peach is Danny's dog.
I was hoping it was the dog, but in any case. So we're going to get an NHL team, and it'll set up in Key Arena, and we have a lot to learn. So every few weeks, we're trying to learn some new hockey lingo.
We've enlisted help this time.
Really?
We've got the Snoop D-O-double-G.
We do.
Snoop Dogg is going to help us with some of the hockey lingo, Dave.
Okay.
This should be very, very fun.
Okay, we ready?
Yes.
Okay. In hockey lingo, what is a pizza?
A pizza is a bad pass of litter that's easily stolen.
A bad pass that what?
Is easily stolen.
Easily stolen.
A okay. pizza. Oh, he served up a pizza. It was easy for me to swipe it and quite delicious.
Okay. How about a celly?
A celly is a hockey celebration after a big goal. Look, he's ice dancing.
These are not in my official hockey lexicon.
We've expanded. You have a glossary that's more technical terms, though it does include a face wash where you just take a snowy glove and rub it into the guy's face.
Well, that happens outside of hockey, too.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so Snoop Dogg, what's a muffin?
A muffin is a weak shot on net.
It was a what?
It's a weak shot on net.
Oh, a weak shot on net.
I thought he said on the nose.
Get that muffin out of here. Oh, he stopped. It was just a muffin. He had a chance to score a goal, but he served up a muffin.
Gotcha. What is a clapper?
A clapper is a slap shot. Not the thing you use to turn the lights on and off. Oh, that's the slap shot. Slapper. Clapper. I call it a sliznapper. You know what I'm talking about?
He's such a treasure.
Sliznapper.
What was that last part?
Sliznapper. Put it in a little Snoop.
None of this stuff is in my glossary.
That's
said,
right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Dave, we're expanding here. We're giving you, it's there's not one single reference, and that's why I thought it was important.
No,
cultural diversity, the sort of things that we can bring to hockey, I think it's important.
It. Lip lettuce.
Lip lettuce is a mustache.
Oh. Well,
also known as lip sweater or muzzy.
Or muzzy.
See, I prefer snot mop.
Ew.
Yeah, I think snot mop is my favorite of all of them.
Gross.
You can see them. They're quite popular up on Capitol
Hill. I'd love
Hill
to hear
right
an
now.
Entire Dave Ross commentary yeah. in Snoop Dogg speak.
That will not be happening.
Come on.
No.
A little stretch goal for you.
No, that will not be happening.
Rob McKenna with the anizzle. Initiative.
That's not my role here. You can do it.
See?
You can get away with it.
I can help you. I can be your translator if you'd like.
Let's see. I was eager to learn the meaning of butt ending.
Butt ending?
Excuse yes.
I think that's the side of the stick. There's the butt end of the stick where if you take that and use it as a pull cue to poke someone.
Yes, very good. The act of jabbing an opponent with the knob of their stick. It's a major plus a game misconduct penalty.
Oh, they don't like that then.
So that gets you kicked out.
Yeah, it'll get you the boot.
Yeah.
You don't want to get butt-ended.
Yeah, it's a 10-minute penalty plus the game misconduct, yeah.
I was going to ask you to explain the delayed offside, but we only have 90 seconds.
Yeah, I have no idea what delayed offside is.
I can tell you what that is really quickly.
All right, go ahead.
Is when the play is played offside, but they don't wave the play dead. So the puck goes across the blue line, and you've already had a person across into that blue line forward area. They wave off because if there's a penalty, they can go the other team can go the other way, so they don't stop play. They let the play continue. Then when the other team touches the puck, then they call the offsides, and then you go back to face-off.
So that...
Did you understand that,
it's basically the It's basically in football where you have a fumble, and you're not sure if it was a fumble or not. They kind of they let the play go to its conclusion, and then they call the offside.
Well, I guess we'll just have to trust the refs on that one. Is there a progress report on the arena project?
I haven't gone out there to see if they've started digging yet. They better get going, though.
I mean, the signs are up.
There's not as much time crunch as there was. When we thought it was going to start in 2020,
right?
That was going to be, they were going to have to haul tail just to get done. It's starting in 2021, so there's much more room for them to do it. But my understanding is that the project is anticipated to be done in plenty of time.
One more thing. Any talks about Russell Wilson's contract yet?
No. We just have that they're not talking. They haven't talked, and people are starting to get worried.
You're playing right into what his agent wants, Dave.
That's exactly right.
Asking about it and hyping it up.
Why isn't it done now?
Danny clearly said August.
August.
Just okay. Relax.
Just
actually, you know what?
The update. That's all.
Here it is. You can ask me beginning July 26th. That's when we'll start, honestly.
That's very specific.
There's a decent chance that the contract is done on July 26th. If it's not done on July 26th, then we can start talking about it.
Okay, so we have a few months to relax. Danny, thank you.
You bet.
And Peach, too.
And no butt sticking or whatever it is.
Butt ending.
Oh, boy.
Butt ending.
You do not like the butt end of this dog, I'll
no,
tell you that.
Do not. Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Let's look ahead to 2020 on the race for the White House. CBS News correspondent Major Garrett is in Washington. Senator Elizabeth Warren has tried and likely failed to put that controversy about her race behind her. Back in the 1980s, on her Texas bar application, she listed American Indian as her race.
Dave, I don't know how to say this any more clearly than this. Whatever people do in political life, they know that they have to make an explanation. And difficult situations require sometimes difficult explanations. Sometimes those explanations work, and politicians live to be political and effective and leaders another day. Sometimes they don't. What almost never works is a multi-layered explanation that keeps repeating the same problem and never fully disclosing the underlying motivations. And that's where it seems to be with Senator Warren, who has demonstrable political skills, has a following of her own, has hired good and solid people in the early primary and caucus states, does look like she could possibly be a contender. But the one thing that has bedeviled her is her own reluctance to come clean on this question fully and without repeating over and over incrementally the same offense. It just astonishes me.
Yeah, and she said that there may even be more documents coming out where she claimed American Indian status based on the...
Find them all, stack them high, apologize, and if you can, try to move on.
So it is... I just was reading on Politico this morning that Joe Biden is coming close to deciding whether to run for president or not. Does this enter into his calculations?
Sure it does, but it's a competitive field. There's going to be lots of other people other than Elizabeth Warren. There will be no shortage of challengers and challenges for Joe Biden. But he looks better than he's ever looked before in terms of the Democratic Party looking to him in favorable ways. He's run before. The one thing I would say about Joe Biden's previous runs, they've always looked better on paper than they played out in reality. That not necessarily will be the case this time. But as for everyone who enters a presidential campaign, usually your best day is the day before you announce. You know, things get much tougher after then.
That's right.
But Joe Biden is going to have to answer for lots of different things, both legislatively and his age, and whether or not he is consistent with the thrust of the Democratic nominating process, meaning the clear impetus within the party to strike positions that are, if not decidedly liberal, have a populist flair and approach to them. Joe Biden looks as if he's positioning himself as not that much, maybe more of a centrist or new Democrat in the Bill Clinton model. Well, that will be different for sure. Whether it's potent enough in early primary and caucus states, hard to know. But he would certainly come in with a lot of the things you consider advantages. A massive national fundraising network, high recognition in all the early primary caucus states, and at least a general sense, he performed well as vice president and has a long time understanding and relationship with the most successful previous Democrat, Barack Obama.
Okay, quick candidate lightning round here. Bernie Sanders, is he running?
It looks like it, but he has a much harder slog than in 2016. That's obvious. And he, I think, would be fifth or sixth among those on the top of most Democrats' minds right now.
Howard Schultz, is he getting anywhere with his independent run?
It's hard. I don't have a feel for that. I have a feel for his seriousness, and I don't have a feel for what his next act is if he says all the things he's already said and adds, oh, I'm running. I just think it sort of sits there, and I don't have a feel for if there's any springboard beneath him at all.
And Washington Governor Jay Inslee, any buzz yet?
Not yet. Doesn't mean there won't be, but he better hurry.
Okay, on the shutdown, I saw something about Nancy Pelosi saying she would accept what the committee comes up with.
Everyone is basically saying to the appropriators, find the money, come up with a deal, and we'll all accept it if you guys can figure it out. That gives them flexibility and latitude, exactly the kind of things appropriators want. Mm-hmm. It feels like everyone, including the White House, does not want to go down this shutdown road again. And they're being given space. The White House is giving them not only room, but talking to them behind the scenes. It feels like something is going to come together, but until we see the details and we get a thumbs up, literally, from the president, we don't know for sure.
CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett. Major hosts The Takeout, which you can hear Sundays here on Cairo Radio.
Enforcement in the...
No, it's your turn, Andrew. There you go. Anna just jumped the gun a little bit.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Wrong button.
These things happen. We'll cut it out of the podcast. Actually, leave it in. People love mistakes in the podcast.
And I rarely make those.
More than a dozen states have now enacted red flag laws, or as they're called in our state, extreme risk protection orders. They allow a court to temporarily remove a person's gun rights when they are deemed a risk to themselves or to others. And for most part, this has been aimed at people dealing with a mental health crisis. But Hannah Scott is here to tell us about a new effort in Olympia to expand the reach of this. Tell us about that.
So there are a few different discussions going on in the legislature right now to expand the use of extreme risk protection orders, or ERPOs, as they're commonly referred to, including an effort to let them be used in with minors. And now Democratic State Senator Mark Elias is proposing another expansion after noticing what he believes is a gap in our voter-approved law.
What I noticed was that hate crimes and threats of hate crimes, you know, weren't on that list. And we know in this era that there's unfortunately been a rise in hate crime activity. And so wanted to be sure that if someone is threatening that sort of hateful conduct, that potential victim could go to court and ask a court to create that protective order and make sure that that person, at least we're keeping guns out of the hands of someone that is threatening that kind of conduct.
So the language in this bill changes the current statute, which refers specifically to dangerous mental health issues, and replaces it with behaviors that represent an imminent threat to themselves or others, to widen that range that a judge can look at when considering whether to grant an ERPO request.
So if he's talking about threats of hate crimes?
Threats of hate crimes, having made an action in a hate crime.
Like a Facebook post or something?
Yeah, absolutely. It can be involving social media. But it's, again, he points out in that area that it's not about, it's up to the judge, right? So mm-hmm. just like it is with the regular ERPO. So as far as social media posts go.
If it's just someone posted a social media post that I don't like, that's why the judge is there to sift through those and make sure that there is really a clear and present danger to someone. So I'm sure that, you know, threatening conduct on social media in conjunction with other kinds of threats, you know, would be something a judge would look at, but it's not going to be as simple as someone said something mean and it made me feel bad. You know, that's what the judge is there for, to make sure that folks, both sides' rights are preserved.
So he says it could have come into play also in a situation in Linwood where a DJ was attacked recently in his own district.
A DJ who was assaulted by some white supremacists at a bar because of his identity. Now, they didn't happen to use firearms, thank God, in that instance. But I think that, you know, there's clearly a rise in this kind of activity. And we want to make sure that if someone has that sort of toxic combination of hateful intent plus access to firearms, that's what the extreme risk protection order was really designed for, to make sure that people that are at risk of criminal conduct don't have access to the most dangerous weapons where they could cause more harm to people.
So that's an actual assault, so I get that. But if somebody had said, hey, meet me at the white supremacist rally on Saturday.
I mean, and that's not a specific threat to someone. So that, and that's a wide ranging thing. This is to allow the individual who feels threatened because somebody went on Twitter or Facebook or something like that and said something negative, whether about their sexuality, their gender.
So
their
that's
race,
how this would play
and
out.
Threatened. Yeah.
The person who was the target of the post or whatever it was would then raise his hand and what, go to a judge and say, disarm this person?
You can file for yourself, just like a family member can file. Right. If they've got someone in their family, in their home, that is being threatening or having a mental crisis. So this would be like that. If you're the victim and you're concerned about a person's behavior who's made a threat like this to you, then you can then petition on your own, which you can get help with at the King County courthouse, or you can ask law enforcement to petition on your behalf. Then it would go before a judge, and then a judge would have to look at the big picture, take everything into account, and decide for themselves whether or not this warrants taking away a person's gun rights temporarily. And so far, what I can tell, the judges really, they're weighing this very carefully. This is a big deal. It's Second Amendment rights. And Leah says this is not about chipping away at Second Amendment rights.
We want to be sure that everyone who's at risk of committing an act of violence, you know, is covered so that we can go to court and, you know, present that evidence to the judge and get the order and protect, you know, community safety, protect folks out there.
I did get a chance to check in with Alan Gottlieb at the Second Amendment Foundation, as well as Dave Workman at thegunmag.com. Both say they cannot get behind this at this point because there's got to be due process, and they don't believe there is here. They think it's kind of a he said, she said type of thing. Leas again stresses.
Well, and the reminder is that before one of these orders can be granted, you have to go to court and present your evidence and your concerns to a judge.
So we'll see how this plays out. It doesn't have a hearing yet. He does expect to get one, though. There's several co-sponsors on here, I believe in some bipartisan support. And there are a couple of larger discussions going on about hate crime bills as well, separate things. So this is a part of a big discussion. ERPO expansion, hate crimes in general, that I think we'll see play out over the next several weeks.
I haven't looked up the stats on it. Has there been any, did Marco offer any research to indicate that a certain percentage of people who make threats like this then go on to commit violent crimes?
He used the example of a trans woman who was murdered a couple of weeks ago, I believe, in another part of the country. But no, not a lot of research yet at this point. I know that there have been cases like that. There's a few I can think of off the top of my head, but I don't know of any solid numbers. But it's something that, you know, he feels passionate about and wants to push for. And I'm sure when it does get a hearing that there would have to be some sort of examples like that given.
Now, as our chief firearms correspondent, does stuff like this make you think that this is not so much about public safety as sort of a backdoor way to get at gun control?
I do not. I really don't. You know, I'm a gun owner. I like my gun rights. And as far as extreme risk protection orders go, I support them so long as, like we're talking about, a judge gives the proper consideration and it's not just willy-nilly taking away someone's gun rights. We know in a mental health crisis that there are definitely situations where a person is a threat, and this can be as much about suicide, right, for the regular IRPOs, as it is a threat to someone else. As far as hate crimes go, I think he's absolutely right. I think that there is a rise. We know that there have been a rise in hate crimes in this country, and I think that there are a rise when we're talking about race, when we're talking about sexual orientation, and if someone is specifically threatening, whether that be on social media or in person, threatening a person, I think that they probably shouldn't have a gun because we don't know at this point, depending, again, on how extreme the circumstance, which would be up to the judge. So I don't feel like it's a backdoor effort to take away gun rights. This is my long answer.
All right. Current is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Truffle time on Seattle's Morning News. Cairo Radio's Rachel Bell is, as we all know, an adventurous eater, and so she set off into the wilderness on a very special hunt.
Come here. What is that? Can you show me?
While trotting through the verdant ferns and mosses in a Stanwood, Washington forest, Alana McGee's dog Lolo sniffed out a black truffle.
So when she finds a truffle, she will scratch and paw at the ground, and then ideally she'll point it out with her nose to us. And then she immediately looks to my bag of chicken to try and get a treat out of it. Yes, good girl. You ready? Go find another one.
Alana owns Truffle Dog Company. She teaches dog owners to train their dogs to be truffle hunters.
Really, any dog can do this. We've trained everything from tiny, like, 4-pound chihuahuas to, yeah. And that's great because they send you photos of, like, truffles the size of the dog's head. So tiny little dogs that you wouldn't think would be good at this to big Bernese Mountain dogs. We had an Akita this year in class. There also is a breed traditionally used in Italy for truffle hunting. It's pronounced Lagotto Romagnolo. Otherwise, we just call them Lagotto. They look like doodles. It's a very old breed. They're sweet. I have two.
She also takes people out on foraging adventures and sells truffles to local restaurants.
I didn't even know there were truffles in Washington State.
Yes, they are everywhere. Mainly on this side of the Cascades, on the Olympic Peninsula, down in Shelton area, Centralia, Longview, everywhere where you have a certain type of dug fur at a certain age.
That is Iko Vale, whose German shepherd named Cowboy sniffed out a whole bag of black truffles in less than an hour.
You got something? Show me. What do you got? Oh, what a dog. What a dog.
There are black and white truffles in Western Washington. Right now is the prime time to find both, and they're hiding just beneath the forest floor. But they look exactly like clods of dirt or rocks. So without the help of a dog, they're pretty hard to hunt down.
There are some people who go out in the forest and look without dogs. It's called raking. When people do it, they pull a ton of the duff, so the top layer of the soil, away, and they don't replace it. And so Iko and I have been to places where the soil has been totally stripped away, and it's really damaging to the environment. It can really erode the habitat, damage salmon streams, all that kind of stuff. And the other one is that when you rake for truffles, you get some that are ripe and some that are unripe. Chefs all throughout the country, until pretty recently, didn't necessarily have a great opinion of truffles coming out of the Pacific Northwest because they've always been given this kind of mixed bag of quality. And so when we use dogs to find truffles, they're only finding the ripe truffles. So we don't find as many, but the quality is much, much higher.
If you've not been lucky enough to smell or taste a truffle, they're very earthy, very pungent.
You want to smell some of the whites?
Yes.
They are super, super, super strong. They were stinking up my car yesterday.
Truffles are in the mushroom family, and the Pacific Northwest variety have a symbiotic relationship with Douglas fir trees. After the hunt, Alana very sweetly gave me a huge bag of truffles and taught me how to infuse foods with them.
Truffles give off this amazing aroma, and it binds with anything with fats or alcohol. So cheese and butter and eggs and all that kind of good stuff. So you literally just take like a stick of butter or whatever butter you have, put it in a sealed container with the truffle just sitting right next to it, not touching, but just right next to it. All of that yummy aroma will go into the things like butter, and then you can use that later.
It is truly magic. You just leave the butter or the cheese or the eggs in the container for about 24 hours, and when you're done, everything tastes of truffle. I infused a stick of butter and a block of sharp cheddar with truffles, and 36 hours later, I used them to make the most delicious macaroni and cheese that I also topped with thin slices of white truffle. I've truffled a squash, I truffled an avocado, I'm currently truffling my stapler. If you want to go out foraging or get your dog trained up or just see pictures of our day out, go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
Is the scent really as horrible as they say?
I love the smell of truffles. I think it smells amazing. It's interesting. It's like, you know, you smell and that's part of your eating experience. But especially with truffles, the aroma is part of the taste. So like a weird fact.
But you don't actually eat them, though.
The truffles, of course you do.
You eat them? I thought you just infuse them into like cooking oil.
No, you shave them onto food as well. So they're kind of work in double time. So you can do the infusions and then you shave them on top, and it is pure luxury. I mean, that's the thing about foraging is all these really expensive, fancy foods are free. So it just feels so exciting. It's like finding something really fancy like Gucci at the thrift store.
As you point out, it's more valuable than gold by weight. So, I mean, do these truffle hunters travel with security or something?
They do have dogs, but just by way of finding the truffles, one of the coolest things that I learned with the infusion process, because the truffles stick to fats, is that you can put some truffles in a closed container with a bunch of raw eggs in their shells. And then after 24 hours, the truffles would have infused through the shell into the yolk of the egg. And anything you make with those eggs, whether it's a quiche or just scrambled eggs or a cake, will have the essence of truffle. I just thought it was so cool.
So you could actually put them in your refrigerator and just infuse everything in your refrigerator with the truffle smell. Sort of a reverse of Arm & Hammer baking soda.
Yes, that is why they tell you to use a very good sealed container, because otherwise your whole fridge will be truffled.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.